Colleagues, I'm calling to order this Friday, April 13th meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. Colleagues, we're going to be spending most of today talking about governance issues, but we do have a couple of work sessions that I'd like to get off the table promptly. And so, with that, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2154. And Victoria, which one is this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2154 requires community college boards to form achievement compact advisory committees and specifies membership and duties, declares emergency effective on passage. You have before you the Dash 2 amendments that expand applicability to public universities and allow currently standing committees with specified membership to be designated as achievement compact advisory committees, and the Dash 4 amendments which remove language requiring the committees to ensure implementation of achievement compacts.
Thank you, Victoria. That would be wonderful.
Okay. Representative Greenwich, would you like to do the honors?
I would be very happy to do that. Where are we? Mr. Chair, I move adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 3/27/13 to the House bill we're talking about.
2154. Representative Greenlich moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated March 27, 2013. Colleagues, just to remind you, the Dash 2 amendments it made some changes, kind of made more general the people who are going to be on these advisory committees. And it also clarified that if there is a standing committee at the college or university, the president does not need to form a new committee. It can just use the standing committee that does this kind of work and will, as part of its charge, review the achievement compacts and help to develop them. So any further discussion of these Dash 2 amendments? Any objection to the Dash 2 amendments? Seeing none, the Dash 2 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the Dash 4 amendments, dated 4/10/13, the House Bill 2154.
Thank you. Rep. Greenlich. Rep. Greenlich moves to adopt the Dash 4 amendments, dated March 10th, 2013. Colleagues, this was the one that we had on Wednesday that I incorrectly thought was incorrect, but in fact it was correct, and that's because I was looking at it in comparison to the Dash 4s, but actually I'm sorry, the Dash 2s, but I should have been looking at it with respect to the base bill. It did do what we had wanted it to do, which was to clarify that the advisory committees, their job is not to implement these compacts, and that was a concern that was expressed to me at the last minute by CCW or OCCA, and they were absolutely correct. I just hadn't noticed that. So this does remove that phrase. So is there any further discussion of the Dash 4s? Any objection to the Dash 4s? Okay, colleagues, the Dash 4s are amended.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2154 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Rep. Greenlich moves House Bill 2154 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Rep. Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to explain my no vote. For the testimony that was presented, I was not convinced that there's a need for the bill, and so I will be a no.
Okay. Thank you, Rep. Huffman. Any further discussion? Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would in some ways echo my colleagues' comments. I think we clearly heard from community colleges and I think from OUS both that they have processes in place for working on their achievement compacts, and it seems to be going very well, and I'm not convinced of the need for this additional committee, so let me know.
Thank you, Rep. Johnson. Yes, Rep. Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a courtesy, do we want Representative Cannon to come up and speak to these? Because I noticed.
Yes. No, that's a fair question, Rep. Gilliam, and we are, of course, honored to have Representative Emeritus Cannon here with us, but the fact is, Rep. Gilliam, we're going to be getting plenty of Rep. Cannon today.
Plenty of Cannon, huh?
Yeah, so.
I'm not sure he's emeritus. I think he's in recovery.
Great. Colleagues, not surprisingly, I support this bill, and I see it as a cleanup bill. There was an error made when we adopted the Achievement Compact bill last session, when it came to the advisory committees, the colleges and universities were inadvertently left off. And this just puts them on where they belong, the same as K-12. Colleagues, there is a bill that's moving through the Senate, I believe, that changes their Achievement Compact advisory committees to add a parent to the committee. I'm not sure where that bill is, but so they're working on cleaning it up as well. This is, I believe, a good bill. The concerns that were expressed by the colleges and universities have been addressed in these amendments, and I, of course, would urge you to reconsider, my good colleagues. But Cassie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Gallegos?
Yes.
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Representative Forsyth?
Yes.
Representative Greenland?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Woodman?
No.
Vice Chair Harper?
Excused.
Vice Chair Hoffman?
No.
Chair Dumbrow?
That's right. Where's Harper?
Oh, darn.
Okay. Let's see. So, yeah, I am going to not complete this vote. I can do that, can't I?
Okay.
I'm feeling a really strong urge to close the work session.
Okay.
Sorry, colleagues. Friday morning, I'm sleeping. I'm gonna. He's gonna be here. All right, I will carry it over for a few minutes. And I will open a work hearing on House Bill, what is it? 2898. Victoria, would you tell us about this bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2898 allows students with disabilities to earn credit at community college or public university as part of transition services, prohibits denying financial aid to student for sole reason that student did not receive standard high school diploma.
Okay. Rep. Huffman?
Over nothing.
We did with this one?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. Chair Dembrough, I move House Bill 2898 to the floor with a... do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Huffman moves House Bill 2898 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to this motion? Seeing none, House Bill 2898 will go to the floor. Representative Gallegos, would you carry this bill for us, please? Thank you. Okay, with that, I'm going to close this work session on House Bill 2898. And I will open the work session on House Bill 2149. And colleagues, I'm opening this session, as I told you the other day, so that Rep. Johnson and I could give you a brief review of what's going on the other side of the building with Senate Bill 270. Senate Bill 270, which is the Institutional Boards Bill, is now in its Dash 4 version, which was just released yesterday. It is the product of a work group that Rep. Johnson and I have been participating in. My sense is that it's close to passage. The deadline is, of course, next week, so it will have to be passed in some form. But We would be happy to talk about it and answer any questions that you might have. We sent you a link to it yesterday. I don't know if you've had a chance to review it. I myself have not had a lot of chance to review it, but I'm sure my good colleague has. So, Rep. Johnson, you want to kick us off?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, maybe it's just helpful for the committee to understand a bit about the context and the work group that's been working on this. And in the room have been Representative Dembro and I, obviously Senator Hass has been there too, along with staff. But also, I think most interesting has been the attorneys representing University of Oregon, Portland State University, and OSU as well, in addition to the OUS legal representation, not to mention at least a couple of drafters from LC. We've had members from the Treasurer's Office. It's a full room. But I think it's been a good faith effort to try to find a way forward that works for everyone, and there's just been a real good, I think, feeling of communication and trying to find that a way that works for those institutions that are represented there, but also ensures that as we move forward that the interests of the OUS system are protected as well. So the bill clearly calls for, allows U of O and PSU to sets a date and time when they can have their independence. It also says that if OSU determines that they want to move forward as well, there's a pathway for that. It also envisions a pathway for the other, you want to call them the regionals or whatever, for them to be able to take that step as well. But lots of effort has gone into talking about bonding capacity, ownership of property, how to utilize the assets, how to leverage them in a way that is beneficial to the universities. We get into specifics, but as well as we address the issue of shared services as well. It creates a commission to examine that and come back with some specific recommendations for the next February session, I believe, as well. Really, and we heard that presentation from Emeritus Pernsteiner last week, who talked about that. So that work is going on as well. So I think the draft, the dash fours, is what we're referring to, Mr. Chair. I think touch on all of those components that have been issues of not contention, but there's been concern about some, but I think to the degree possible, this finds a spot where everybody in the room can agree that this is a good way forward for Oregon. It's a good way forward for those institutions, and I think it's a good work. So I think we're very close, from my understanding. I think Senator Hass, I think they adopted the amendments yesterday.
They did.
I don't think they've moved the bill. They'll probably move that on Tuesday, I'm guessing.
Yes. And just to follow on that, I know that this committee has been concerned about the bonding issue and just making sure that the state's interests are protected in the new bonding authority that the institutional boards will have. Just to remind you that Senate Bill 242, which we passed back in 2011, which moved the university system from being a state agency to being a public university system, did give universities the ability to do revenue bonding, but that was had to be done under the auspices of the State Board of Higher Education. What this bill will allow them to do is they'll allow the individual institutions to do that. There are challenges to that in that if the institution gets in over its head and then as a result has difficulty repaying the bonds that it already holds, that the state holds on its behalf, because we have been bonding for the universities for many years, then the state is potentially on the hook. As you can imagine, that makes Treasury very, very nervous. And so they have been involved in this, trying to make sure that their interests are protected. I did put out an inquiry to Treasury to see where they are on the dash fours, if the dash fours capture their concern. I haven't heard back from them yet, but I assume that we will hear back from them before the bill is voted out of the Senate.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So since we haven't really had a chance to look at the dash fours, we're not certain, maybe Representative Johnson knows, because I have been concerned that we have Treasury involvement, continued involvement and oversight, maybe not control, but at least advisory. And do you know if dash fours spell that out, or is that what you were suggesting we're not sure on yet.
I'm not sure. The goal was to make that happen. To be honest, colleagues, I'm not sure if it goes as far as I would like. I would like to see not only advice, but an approval function for Treasury for these, for bond issuance. That would make me feel more comfortable. I'm not sure that this goes that far, and we'll find out if it goes far enough.
Okay. Mr. Chair, there's at least three or four sections of this bill that are specifically about the Treasury's involvement, about bonding. It's quite in-depth. To me, it looks very conclusive that, yes, Treasury has a significant role in here, as well as the legislature in terms of oversight as well.
Mm-hmm. Great. In terms of the timeline for what's being envisioned in 270, what's being envisioned is that beginning with starting with the ultimate passage of the bill, governor will begin identifying candidates for these boards, and they will probably start being formed as early as next fall. They will require Senate confirmation. They won't be achieving their full powers, their full authorities, until July of 2014, but they will start forming and getting up to speed on issues, and in some cases perhaps even being able to exercise their bonding authority. July of 2014 is also when the HEC achieves its full new status, and we'll be hearing about that. We'll be talking about that. It's critical that the HEC be empowered in its new way to become the new coordinating board for the universities that have their own institutional boards. Because there are a number of elements of Senate Bill 270 that require that there are things that the HEC will have to do. For example, with respect to tuition, you'll recall that Senate Bill 270 limits the authority of institutional boards to tuition increases up to 5% for resident undergraduate students. And anything in excess of that would need to be approved by the HEC. Similarly, new programs or significant changes to existing programs or new locations for programs are going to have to be authorized by the HEC. You'll be hearing a lot more about that. Therefore, it's important that the new powers of the HEC and the full authority of the institutional boards line up. Ultimately, we're going to need these two bills to be either, physically combined or conceptually combined. But that probably is not going to happen at this level. It'll happen after they go to Ways and Means. Further questions?
Sure. Yes. Pending your careful reading of the desk drawers, are you saying you support the bill?
I will say I still have a problem with, we're not quite there from my perspective on the board composition issue. I can't remember now if I talked about this last week. I think I did. I had believed that we had an agreement that the boards would have a student, a faculty member, and a non-teaching staff person on them, and that the faculty and the non-teaching staff person would be non-voting unless the board decided by its policy to allow them to vote. So that question of voting would be left up to the individual board. The dash fours, let's just say there was a change between what I understood as the agreement and what became the dash fours. And so what the dash fours contain is no staff person, a faculty member in a non-voting capacity.
And a voting student.
And a voting student, right. for me, that's missing a really key ingredient. And to be for me to be fully supportive of the bill, it's going to require you know what I thought was the understanding.
Is that the only problem you have with it?
You know, again, I need to feel satisfied with this bonding piece. You know, if I hear from the treasurer that, you know, that Treasury is comfortable with where we are, then I can be comfortable once the board piece is settled.
Thank you.
Okay, any further questions about Senate Bill 270? We will be coming back to it as we hear from Emeritus Cannon. Okay, with that, then, I'll close this work session on House Bill 2149. And I'm going to reopen the work session on 2154. Rep. Parker, just to bring you up to speed, we did adopt the amendments to House Bill 2154.
It's nothing personal that my script is canceled out.
That's first right. Half of you can't handle
it. I'm going to wind up on the cutting room floor. Okay. In that case, Chair Dambrow, I move House Bill 2154, as you folks have amended it, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Harker moves House Bill 2154 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Does it do any good for me to further object or just...
Can I vote again?
Do I get to vote again? And does it count double? Or
if you are willing to change from a nay to a yay, you can speak. Good representative. Okay, Cassie, would you please recall the roll?
Representative Gallegos.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam.
No.
Representative Gorsuch.
Yes.
Representative Greenlee.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative
Woodman? No.
Vice Chair Hunter?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hunter?
No.
Chair Dambrow?
Aye. The motion passes. I will carry the bill. Okay, with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2154. And I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3120. And I'll call up the good policy advisor. And colleagues, as Mr. Cannon is getting settled in, you know, 3120, of course, is the larger governance bill, and it addresses. I think some of the concerns that were expressed in the audit that we received the other day from the Secretary of State, and I just want to read a paragraph from that audit just to sort of kick this off, and I think frame the conversation that I hope we're going to have today. And this is, you know, this is under the heading that for OUS governance and accountability need clarification. Clear governance structures and goals can reduce inefficiency, limit duplication of efforts, and improve accountability. Rather than ensuring effectiveness and efficiency, Oregon's current education governance structure risks creating confusion and a lack of accountability. There is overlap in roles and authority between the Oregon Education Investment Board, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and the State Board of Higher Education. In addition, there are three sets of overlapping performance measures with different reporting structures. As a result, the actual relationship between performance and funding is unclear, as is the entity responsible for monitoring performance and approving funding. And it goes on in the main part of the audit to explain, you know, just how this problem came about and why it's an ongoing problem and why it needs to be addressed. And I would argue, colleagues, that House Bill 3120 is our effort to ameliorate this problem. So, Mr. Cannon.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Governor's Education Policy Advisor. Unlike the Chancellor Emeritus, I was not permitted to retain my email address, but I am enjoying all the other perks and privileges associated with being a former representative, namely, not many. But very grateful to be with you today, and I think Representative Dembro prefaced this work well. It's sort of describes one of the biggest challenges of my work over the last year and a half, and certainly perhaps the biggest challenge of my work related to post-secondary education has been the real lack of clarity around governance, authorities, accountability, responsibility, the statutes, as a result of, I think, very good intention, and certainly a lot of important effort over the last couple of years, have created some incredible opportunities, but have also created some confusion. And we think that this session, working with Representative Dembro and this committee, as well as Senator Haass and his committee, there's just we're poised to make a lot more sense of this kind of higher education soup than we have today. So what I have proposed to do is sort of pick up on the 270 discussion and then walk us into 3120. So I wanted to start with this chart that you've seen a version of before, and I apologize that I don't have this. A couple of caveats. This is a draft presentation that hasn't been vetted by a lot of folks who want to have a look at this before it goes very much further. And I don't have handouts that reflect this, so you'll have to do your best to follow it on the screen, and my apologies, I will send it out as soon as we get a little bit more feedback, even as early as later today. So just to sort of tell you what you're looking at here, and acquaint you with the colors and keys. So the blue bars here that you see on the kind of at the middle of the slide, the State Board of Higher Ed and the OSAC and State Board of Ed, and then those blue bars above the 17 community colleges, those are boards. Some of them are institutional boards and some of them are state boards. The orange boxes are institutions, so we have 7 universities over on the left-hand side and 17 community colleges on the right. I've gone ahead and shown the students as well, because if you're thinking about how the state funds higher education, one of the ways that we fund higher education is through the Oregon Opportunity Grant and its disbursement to students for financial aid. The lines, you'll see 3 different kinds, and they're described in the key at the left, lower left. The solid blue line represents what we'll call governing authorities, and by that I mean, and we've used governing so many different ways over the last couple of years, but in this context, what I mean by governance are really the powers that we associate typically with governing boards and institutions, especially the power to adopt a local budget, the power to hire and fire the executive, the power to establish sort of local policies for institutions. And so, for example, the State Board of Higher Ed today really has those authorities for our 7 universities. They are a single legal entity. The State Board of Higher Ed is its governing board that establishes policies for those 7 institutions, obviously hires the presidents and the chancellor. The purple dashed line reflects a different type of authority, and this really is this distinction between the blue solid line and the purple dashed line really is at the understanding this distinction is really at the core of understanding Senate Bill 270 and House Bill 3120. The purple dashed line is meant to represent the allocation of state dollars, and the establishment of state rules and authorities that relate to sort of the state interest in the system. So, for example, and I've just put some examples of those in the key, but mission and program approval is done by the State Board of Higher Ed today for 7 universities. It's done by the State Board of Ed for our 17 community colleges on the program side, not the mission slide. So there's one correction already. These represent, I'd say, not direct governance authorities in the way that we have thought of it in terms of local institutions, but the state's interests in coordinating and creating a coherent system. And then finally, you don't see any of these brown arrows that are represented in the very lower left of the key yet, but you will. And those represent more sort of real soft responsibilities of advice and coordination. So the slide that you're looking at here and the structure you see here is the what I'll call the pre-2011 structure, the one that we're pretty familiar with for higher education. As you're aware, in 2011, with the passage of Senate Bill 242, we established a Higher Education Coordinating Commission that, for the most part, under current law, has authorities or responsibilities that are in the category of advice and coordination. And it has those responsibilities with respect to the entire post-secondary system, universities, community colleges, financial aid. It has responsibilities for developing a strategic plan, developing budgeting and sort of investment recommendations, and advising and institutions on missions and programs. And those authorities were generally construed to be advisory. There are a few exceptions to that that would complicate this chart, but generally you can understand the HEC today as a kind of advisory and coordinating body, and of course it's one that we didn't fund in the 2011 session, and as such it's operated with, I'd say, real minimal authority and ability. So we'll call that the current law. What you don't see here is the OEIB. Of course, the OEIB is an overarching P20 board that operates in conjunction with the HEC to provide advice and coordination for the entire P20 system.
Arrows.
The advice, the arrows reflect the advising
OEIB,
and coordinating.
Sorry. The investment board have arrows like this?
Yeah, I would describe the OEIB's authorities primarily like the HECS as being advisory and coordinating for the entire P20 system. One distinction, of course, is that the OEIB hired a chief education officer who has actual authorities relative to our chancellor, our community college commissioner, our OSAC executive director, and the OEIB has a very clearly articulated role in helping to develop the governor's investment budget advisory to you, of course, for education P20. But if I were to include the OEIB here, it would be in an additional bar, pretty closely connected to the HEC, but obviously spanning P20. And primarily with authorities that are in this kind of third category of advising and coordinating. So I'm going to take us into 270 now, and so the focus in 270 is only on the left-hand part. 270 doesn't say anything about OSAC and financial aid or community colleges and the State Board of Ed. So the focus now will be on the left-hand, just the university system, as we look at 270. And the 270 anticipates a very different organization of the university system. Essentially, under 270, the university system goes from being one legal entity to three or four. I probably should have asterisked Oregon State University, since under 270, a board is not established for OSU until and unless the president of that institution chooses to have one. But it does establish boards for U of O and PSU, and it re-establishes the State Board of Higher Education essentially as a institutional board for a consortium of four institutions. And so I've put them kind of in alignment. They have a sort of parallel authorities. And they are the authorities associated with this blue bar, governing authorities, the hire and fire power, the adopting of a local budget, the establishment of sort of local policies or institutional policies.
Yes, Rep. Greenlick. By saying a consortium of four, that implies some interrelationship that may not be the case. I think you may be saying it's just literally the four.
independent institution, I think. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick.
The 270 say anything about that? That's the question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, 270 maintains the State Board of Higher Ed as the governing, in the way that I've used the word here, board for the four institutions.
Not necessarily a consortium of the four.
I think depending on, from a legal standpoint, I probably go out on a limb here that I am unqualified to go out on. But legally, what would exist is, whereas today we have one entity, a university system with, if you will, a consortium of seven universities operating under that single State Board of Higher Education, what is proposed in 270 is what you see here.
Mr. Chair, I'm not raising this as a linguistic. I see the 17 community colleges as a consortium.
Mm-hmm.
They join together voluntarily to serve some common purpose.
Mm-hmm.
The universities are not that. They are four separate institutions.
Right. That's a fair point. We've been, as a kind of shorthand, referring to it as the consortium board. But, you know, really what it is what you might think of as the board of technical and regional universities. That's what it will be, at least in the short term. And you'll hear that we've already made reference to that being something that's also going to be looked at between now and February. Is that the best ongoing model for the regional and technicals, or you know, should there be some other model for them? Needless to say, they will be very highly involved in that conversation and decision.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir, of course.
In terms of that, of the four, I would suggest that we need to look very carefully at the relationship of OIT to the other three, simply because they have a very different mission and really different equipment needs and so forth for their classes. So hopefully that'll be something that's taken into account as we go on.
Chair Dembrough, Representative Gorsuch, I can only echo, I think, Representative Dembrough's comments about the assumption in 270 that there will be significant addition. It's not an assumption. It is embedded, planned within 270, established within 270, is an ongoing process to evaluate exactly the type of issue that you're raising, Representative Gorsuch, about whether this model of a four-institution or four campus institution, depending on how you want to look at it, is the right way to go. And I think speaking for the governor, this what is shown here, it does not necessarily reflect our optimal landing spot for this. The governor is certainly open to the possibility that one or more of the four would have an institution-specific board, and there are undoubtedly other arrangements that could work for those four.
Thanks. Rip Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ben, I understand that you're showing the reality of 270, but in practicality, would until President Ray so chooses to have an institutional board, would OSU actually come down and make five under the State Board of Higher Ed?
Representative Dembrough, Representative Huffman, yes. Under 270, unless President Ray chooses, OSU would be in that with the four.
Right.
May have been maybe more sort of accurate to include OSU on the line with the other four. We don't know.
Let me leap in and say this will come up later. I've already alluded to the timeline that we're looking at. You know, essentially for the next year, the governance authorities will remain as they currently are. So this process that will be going on between now and the February session will you know, settle out some of these issues. My hope is, and I made this request last night in a telephone conversation to a person that I won't name, but who's associated with Oregon State University, was that, you know, it would be great if we could get that decision made before the February session. And so the hope is that that will happen, and then, you know, when it's time for the new authorities to be fully formed, this, you know, we'll know where we're going.
Well, if President Gray doesn't do what the board wants, they can fire him and get a president. They've done something like that before, I think.
Why don't you proceed, Ben?
Representative Devereaux, I will do that. So while we're still in 270, I do want to point out what you're seeing now includes just these solid blue bars on the university system where the boards of the three PSU, potentially OSU, U of O, and the State Board of Higher Ed are responsible for example, hiring of the presidents of those respective institutions. As far as the kind of state funding allocation questions and questions of how the state maintains authorities for things like approving or refining missions, approving programs, adopting state rules for the system as a whole, this is where Senate Bill 270 gets us part of the way, but I would argue not all of the way. So essentially, Senate Bill 270 assumes that, and I keep using this word, it doesn't assume, it establishes that program approval authority, for example, and state funding allocations for the two or three institutions with institution-specific boards is done by the HEC. And this is a big deal because for the first time in law, then, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission would have some of these, what are represented here as kind of dashed purple funding authorities, for example, for those institutions. So the HEC, receiving an appropriation from the legislature, would in turn allocate that appropriation among the three. And likewise, the HEC would adopt program approval for the three. Meanwhile, for the four, what are here, you know, we've loosely described as that consortium, but where the four would go for program approval is to their board, the State Board of Higher Ed, which appears to me to be an insufficient outcome in order to ensure kind of clear state coordination and clarity in the system, because essentially for certain institutions would go to one board, the State Board of Higher Ed, in order to get a new program approved, for example. Other institutions would go to the HEC. Senate Bill 270 has come a long way in terms of really establishing that the HEC would be the primary rule setter, if you will, for state authorities. But what you have here, and this is my final 270 slide, is a Higher Education Coordinating Commission with direct authorities relative to things such as new academic program approval for PSU and U of O and possibly OSU, and with an advisory and coordinating responsibility for the State Board of Higher Ed and its four constituent institutions, as well as, of course, for continuing for financial aid and for community colleges. So you have a Higher Education Coordinating Commission that's both advisory and coordinating for much of the P20 system, and then has some very specific responsibilities relative to the institutions with their own institutional boards. Again, it's a slightly more, and I'm also just digesting the -4 amendments on 270. This has shifted, I mean, things have shifted to make it somewhat more Higher Education Coordinating Commission focused, but this is essentially what, roughly, what 270 establishes. And from the governor's standpoint, especially in the context of institutional boards, we have to be careful to find ways to ensure that the system, the higher education system generally, does not become more fractured, but instead becomes more coherent, and that the system-wide properties are maintained or enhanced. And 270 gets most of the way or much of the way there, but we would argue there needs to be some additional work, and as a result have been spending a lot of time and energy with Representative Denbrough and a number of stakeholders on 3120. So I'm going to use this 270 slide as sort of the jumping off place for 3120 and what's proposed in that bill. The first thing that we do is in 3120 is clearly establish the Higher Education Coordinating Commission as the statewide entity commission responsible for funding, program approval, adopting state rules relative to the entire university system, and it's four under 270. It would be four respective governing boards. So that advisory bar has been converted now into a purple dashed line to reflect that fulfillment of its responsibilities. Then we've gone on to, in 3120, also
remember that.
Try to bring greater levels of coordination across the higher education system by transferring authorities from the State Board of Education for community colleges to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and for OSAC from financial aid for financial aid to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. So this would eliminate OSAC and transfer those authorities to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and it would eliminate the State Board of Ed's responsibilities for community colleges and transfer those to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. So a single commission at the state would be responsible for the state's authorities relative, including funding distributions, subject to the legislative approval, funding distributions for the entire post-secondary system. So in our view, you go from having a jumble of boards, frankly, to a single board or commission that has these authorities and can exercise these authorities in a calibrated way for all of higher education. In order to...
Yes, Rep. Greenlick.
To think back, putting program authority into the HEC for the community colleges, was there a predecessor organization that did program? I didn't see that.
Yeah, so Representative Greenlick, Chair Denbrough, good point. So the what I've shown on these two clips is just a transfer of existing authorities from one board to the HEC. And so in the case of community colleges, yes, the State Board of Education has that authority today, and what 3120 would do is transfer it to the HEC. And it would get the State Board of Education out of the business of community colleges. The State Board of Education wouldn't go away. It would continue to exercise very important responsibilities relative to pre-K through grade 12. Likewise, for OSAC, there's not an assumption of new authorities, but there is a transfer of authorities from the Oregon Student Access Commission to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission.
Thank you. Very helpful.
Yes, Rep. Pusman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cannon, so if all the regional and the tech university side, they want to have their own institutional, does the SBHE go away?
Representative Denbrough, Representative Wisnett, I suppose it would depend on how the legislation was drafted. Arguably, the State Board of Higher Ed, as we know it, has gone away under 270, but it hasn't been renamed. And under 270, the State Board of Higher Education has no direct authority for U of O and PSU, for example. So, but it's still called the State Board of Higher Ed. And, you know, I think we'd face that question. That question would be called even further every time an institution leaves it.
Mm-hmm. So does the bills we're looking at now address that if that does happen? Because we're giving them the option of having their own institutional boards. So that I think the legislation should address that, because that would go away. Otherwise, I don't see a function for them.
So, Representative Denbrough, Representative Wisnett, as I understand the effect of Senate Bill 270, which is where the changes you're describing are included, it is the case that with institutional boards at PSU and U of O under 270 and maybe at OSU, the authorities of the State Board of Higher Ed are significantly Well, first of all, the State Board of Higher Ed would have no authorities for, essentially, for U of O and PSU. And its authorities for the other four are shared, in a sense, with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, because program approval that the State Board of Higher Ed does today would be subject to approval by the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. So it's a very different board. And I think that's your point. It legally, in 270, it is still called the State Board of Higher Ed, and that may very well be something that this...
It may be before the end of the session that name changes. We'll see. But the final determination will come as we envision it in the February session.
I just like this. Yes.
And maybe there'll be five universities by then, Rep. Wisman.
Mr. Kent, I just want to echo what Representative Gorsuch said, too. I think that OIT has an interest, and I'm glad that the both bills have the means for some universities, but also the regionals and the tech, to have their own institutional board, because I think OIT does have an interesting mission that we should support. Thank you.
Rep. Gorsuch.
Mr. Cannon, I just have one kind of overarching question for you. Compared to what we currently have and what we're going towards, do we know the cost difference between those two systems?
Representative Gorsuch, Chair Dembrough, really good question. The answer is no, not specifically. Okay. This bill, should it move from this committee, well, even before it moves from this committee, will be subject to fiscal analysis by LFO and agency staff, and I suspect Ways and Means will be spending a whole lot more time on that very question. The work has been premised on our part on the notion that there are, at least over time, some potential, some actual efficiencies to be gained through having a single board do the state's work rather than three or four, as is the case today. We had also, as you know, originally proposed to have a single agency supporting that board and doing the work of three or four. That is no longer in 3120, and I'll get to that in a moment. But that could be a sort of subsequent step the legislature chooses to take, perhaps in the interest of efficiency. We've done some analysis of that, the sort of potential cost savings there, but it's still early days, I would say.
Thank you.
Important question. So, speaking of agencies, I mean, as I alluded to, that originally when you heard about this bill, and this work, the governor's budget and this bill in its initial draft or in its initial amendment describe the creation of a single Department of Postsecondary or Office of Postsecondary Education to provide the staff support to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission for its what under 3120 would be really significant authorities for funding distribution and program approval, et cetera. Under the amendments to 3120 that you have seen more recently, the Department of Postsecondary or Office of Postsecondary is not created. Instead, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission would work through the existing Community College and Workforce Development Department headed by its commissioner. The Oregon Student Representative Denver, I think, changed. It will still be, I have to check this latest draft, but essentially an office that Oregon Student Access Commission office, if you will, headed by an executive director.
That does the work.
That these would be the staff who are supporting the HEC and the adoption of their rules and the disbursement of funding. And likewise, on the university side, there is an assumption that there would be a need for staff to support the HEC in the deployment of its responsibilities relative to the universities that it is responsible for. So we have attempted in the draft that you see more recently to leave the agency structure standing. Clearly, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission would require some, and I think it's yet to Representative Gorsuch's questions are yet to be determined, kind of staffing level at a minimum executive director, a position that's in current law but unfunded, some staffing in order to sort of ensure that this work is coordinated and the commission itself has supported. On the sort of cost saving side, I think, you know, clearly we would no longer be supporting the Oregon Student Access Commission directly and the State Board of Ed for Community College Functions directly, and much more of the university system work would be done at an institutional level and not at the state. So there are the potential advantages.
Yes. Rep. Greenlick.
I like tables of organization. Are you saying that those boxes are not directly governed by the HEC? I mean, because I would assume they're just staff of the HEC in different names, which would require then somehow to show those as being reporting to the HEC.
Representative Greenlick, Representative Dembro, I believe, and Representative Dembro has been developing these amendments that you and I have just seen, but I believe that the HEC, under these amendments, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission would oversee a director who in turn would oversee the staffs of each of these offices. Mm-hmm. However, they would remain in their existing agencies, at least in the case of CCWD and the Oregon Student Access Commission, their existing offices, if you will. There's not a single department created here, but it certainly points towards a single place of authority for the executive branch staff relative to post-secondary. We got to this point when we were working on this back in November, the OEIB subcommittee and others, and said, well, if you're going this far, create a single agency. I think there's been enough of a sense that that's a bridge too far this session for us to sort of take it to here and say, well, let's let this evolve.
But Mr. Chair, wouldn't these be staff departments of the HEC, in essence? I mean, is that not what's intended?
I believe in the long term that is what's that is what's intended, Rip Greenlick. And I think the idea is that eventually we will get to something like the Office of Post-Secondary Education and Workforce Development. As I mentioned last week, there are just so many details to that, so many T's to cross and I's to dot, that it would be a mistake to do that this session, given the deadlines that we're facing, and that actually we don't need to do that this session.
Well, but one infers from this that they're sort of independent agencies rather than a part of the HEC.
So Representative Green and Representative Demmer, I think there's a way in which a subsequent version of this can more clearly illustrate how these light blue agency bars would be integrated at the HEC level. Certainly the intent is that the HEC would be the policy setting authority for all that the blue bars here are responsible for, and the HEC executive director would be responsible for the agencies that are represented by those blue bars, would oversee those agencies. So organizationally, I think there's a way, and that's the intent, and I think there's a better way to depict it here.
Mm-hmm. And also I will add, and I just want to say this for the record, that it's going to be very important for us, even if eventually we have a single office of post-secondary, that the different missions and functions of the community colleges and the universities are respected and maintained.
Absolutely.
That's one of the things that is causing us to want to go about this very, slowly and deliberately.
So, Mr. Chair and committee members, I know there are other folks here whose thoughts I think would be important for you to hear relative to this work. I did prepare with Representative Dembro a couple of handouts. I don't know if those have been circulated or not. One is a one-pager front and back. Have those been handed out? Okay, so one is a one-pager front and back, untitled, but with a five numbered points that are reflected in this slide here on 3120. It essentially describes the sort of five main things that 3120 does. It rewrites the HEC's general authorities, and there's a separate handout, that's the second handout, to show you what those are, or what those are proposed to be. So where we've taken the HEC's sort of authorizing statutes and said, well, if it's going to do this, how would you reflect that in statute? The number two, the transfers of specific authorities from Board of Ed and OSAC to the HEC. Number three, the HEC membership and changes to it, specifically the fact that under 3120 in this amendment, the governor would be permitted to appoint a new Higher Education Coordinating Commission on the effective date of that section, and our intent would be to do that soon after the passage of the legislation. Number four, that the HEC would have this, to Representative Greenlick's question, the HEC would have staffing authority and oversight authority for the existing agencies and their directors starting on July 1st, 2014, and then the timelines in number five. And really, we've gotten to a point now, and something I'm very pleased to say about the work in 270 and 3120, there's a coherent timeline for all of this, and it's one that allows for a deliberate transition. Most of the authorities that institutional boards assume in 270 are effective July 1st, 2014. Likewise, the new authorities that the HEC would receive are effective July 1st, 2014. So there would be really a year of transition. 270 establishes a narrow set of authorities that would come online sooner for universities, but I think it's an appropriate landing spot and allows for a deliberate transition there. The other handout, as I mentioned, is
Ben, could you hold on? Representative, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cannon, so what the three page.
That's what he's about to give.
That's in statute now.
So, Representative Dembro, Representative Wisnett, that is the proposed rewrite of the HEC general authority statute. So, today in law, ORS 351.735 establishes the authorities for the HEC. This is what would replace 735 under the bill.
And to your question, this is incorporated in, you know, the draft -3 amendments. However, this is much more readable than that. No aspersions to Dan, our drafter, who's doing a great job, but, you know, that is all broken up with what's being cut out and added.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Cannon. I hope both of you and the governor on GB only talks about annual increases in tuition fees. I hope you'd reconsider that and talk about sometime it could maybe go down. I don't like 5%. Putting 5% without tying it to cost of GP, you know, the gross national product or cost of living, whatever index or something like that, instead of just saying we can go up 5%. I'd like you to really look at that.
Representative Demmer, Representative Wisnett, 270 speaks to this and creates a kind of aspirational goal that the universities are keeping their tuition in line with an inflation index, and then the backstop to that is this approval required for greater than 5% increases. It is, in my view, it is a sort of crude one, right? But that's why it's not an arbitrary. They can't increase more than 5%, and there is a process through which they would need to come to the legislature to the HEC.
I think the universities, I support them having the flexibility to raise the fees to keep it because we don't give you enough. So.
No, and actually 270 calls that out specifically. You know, the aspiration is that the legislature will appropriately fund the universities, and then the tuition increases can be kept in line with cost of living.
Chair?
Yes, Rep. Greenlee.
I have to say, this is pending the question of how the OEIB relates to all this, and we're crowding around that. This is the first time this is beginning to make sense without having things inside it that I don't understand. So I do appreciate your working in it.
Thank you.
Getting towards what could be a coherent model.
Thank you, Rep. Greenlee. Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ben, the lines look fine, the arrows, all of that are an improvement, but my concern is the makeup of the HEC. And in the amendments here that we received last night about 9:30, we're now adding to the existing HEC, we're going to call out for one faculty member of a university, we're going to call out for a faculty member of a community college, we're going to call out for one non-faculty member of staff, with addition to two students. And we've got a 15-member board, so out of 15, we've got five who are either students or faculty, and then there's 10 at-large or general public members and so forth. So we've radically changed how the HEC was staffed initially under the legislation we passed back in the previous session. But my concern is this, and I think some of us would agree, as you look at the OEIB, I think one of the issues we have with the OEIB is we've created a stakeholder board where we have individuals that are there because of who they represent rather than because of the giftings and the qualifications they bring to the table. And we're empowering a new agency here, a new organization, and it would seem to me that as a state, it's in our all best interest to have the best and brightest from the higher ed world and from the state of Oregon there because of what they bring to the table, not because of who they represent. So does the governor have a position or some thoughts on this matter? But I'd love for you to kind of talk to that a bit.
Representative Johnson, Representative Denbrough, it's an important issue and obviously one we've been dealing with in the context of both the institutional boards as well as starting to deal with in the context of this bill and the HEC. In general, sort of philosophically, the governor is predisposed to prefer boards that are less specific in their membership requirements and provide for the governor to appoint people who are really serving the interests of Oregon as a whole. As I think all of our, you know, volunteers on these commissions come with that aspiration, but some also come very clearly with a kind of organizational responsibility and a slot that they're filling. And generally speaking, the governor has preferred not to do that. He has not taken a specific position on this question of HEC membership or, frankly, on the institutional board membership. We are concerned that this broader piece of work not get hung up on those questions, although we acknowledge they are important ones and ones to resolve clearly and fairly. I say as a general principle, the governor would be probably more comfortable with a smaller higher education coordinating commission, not larger. It is also the case, however, that I think most people would agree that the existing State Board of Higher Ed has operated reasonably well as at a larger size, and I mean, it's gone now to 15 members. Not all of those positions are filled. I think that's correct, 15, and it does have specific slots for students and faculty. At the end of the day, it's in my experience, reflecting on the variety of boards and commissions we work with, question's answered is important, but it's not probably the, the effectiveness of a board has to do with a lot of factors. This is one of them. And it may be not the very most important. You know, boards develop cultures of their own. One of the challenges of the HEC is it won't have much of a culture to walk into, right? It'll be creating that culture. And so maybe this question becomes particularly important in that context. State Board of Higher Ed has a kind of culture, and so, faculty members coming into their faculty slots are kind of walking into a culture where they're expected not to be just the representatives of faculty, but really serving the interests of Oregon as a whole. So I think those are some of the kinds of dynamics that we need to be thinking about. We'd certainly appreciate additional attention on the part of this committee and the legislature to this issue.
Ben, let me just jump in and say that, you know, I will concede that the addition of the staff person on the HEC is a change. The State Board of Higher Ed currently and for many years, you know, has had two faculty, two students on it. You remember Matt Donegan coming and talking to us in the special committee saying how he appreciated how well that worked, how those faculty and students really did, as Ben mentioned, see their fiduciary responsibilities as to, you know, the entire board, not to their particular constituencies. The existing HEC now has two faculty and two students. This, you know, was envisioned to just move that forward, essentially.
Mr. Chair, we've also had a board of ed that I don't think spells out either students or staff, and it's functioned pretty well for a number of years as well.
Yes, the Board of Ed has, you know, added over the years, has seen fit to add a number of advisor positions that are, you know, is seeking to do something very similar But, you know, this, well, this will be a subject of debate.
Representative Johnson, Representative Dunbar, I agree. I mean, there are various models that can work. The OEIB, incidentally, does not have slots in law. So, you know, there are a variety of ways, and I think that reflects the governor's preference for that that model. There are a variety of ways that these things can work. Representative Gilliam, you've
yes.
been noticeably quiet.
I'm so impressed that you're actually working over there.
I'm holding you down.
You're holding you down. Excellent work.
Okay, so Ben, were you thinking of walking us through the authorities, or what was your plan?
At your pleasure, Mr. Chair, I would require a copy of them. I didn't
know
if you wanted to. I'd be happy
That's
to
fine.
Do that.
You know, probably we don't need to do that. But, you know, I would really encourage you, colleagues, to look at these authorities. You know, I think you will appreciate what you see here in terms of this, you know, calling out the expectation that the HEC is really going to be setting, you know, general policy and doing the strategic planning for all of post-secondary. And when I say all of post-secondary, you know, I'm not just talking about the publics here, too. You know, also, they need to think about the role of the independent colleges and universities and the for-profit colleges and universities, the role of philanthropy and various kinds of partnerships that can be envisioned. And I'll just say, I mentioned this to Ben this morning as we were driving in and chatting over the phone, that in a hands-free environment, by the way, I was at a town hall last night. There was an education town hall, and we were talking about the Oregon Opportunity Grant because Treasurer Wheeler was there as well, and he was talking about the Opportunity Initiative. And I mentioned to the assembled people that, you know, just how underfunded the Opportunity Grant is and how, you know, fewer than 20% of those who are eligible are actually getting them. And in many cases, a person might have it 1 year, and then because of funding changes, they lose it, and then maybe they get it back or whatever. And as someone who I think was probably a student herself, as a young woman, said, well, you know, would it be possible to do the Opportunity Grant so that the grant is given for 2 years at a time, or perhaps even 4 years at a time, so that the student would be guaranteed, you know, if as long as they kept up their grades, that there would be some stability there and they wouldn't have to drop out. And, you know, I told her, you know, first of all, what a great question that is. And that was actually something along those lines, was a recommendation of the Student Success Task Force that we had meeting last year. But, you know, right now, the decision over that question would need to be made by three different boards, right? There's not a single entity that could look at, you know, the big picture of reconfiguring the Opportunity Grant. We can do that. We can have those conversations here because, you know, we're the committee on the entirety of higher education. But the goal is that the HEC will be perfectly poised to have that kind of conversation. Okay, we have this amount of resources. How best do we deploy these so that, you know, we're incentivizing completion and incentivizing quality and student success? So that's the hope here. That's the vision.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ben. Why don't we call up some of our stakeholders here? You know, on the one-page handout at the top of it, you know, it mentions just, you know, who all were involved in the work group that has been working on this. And, you know, we had legislators, representatives of the Oregon University System, State Board of Higher Ed, Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, OSAC, the Oregon Student Association, Oregon Community College Association, Associated Oregon Industries, Oregon Community Foundation, AFT Oregon, Portland State University, Eastern Oregon University, and others. It was, and they've been very, very helpful. So why don't we hear from a few of them to give us their perspective. And as always, we must start with the students if Emma's here. Is Emma here? No. She stepped out. She'll be back. Let's see. Gary, would you come up? And Andrea? Okay, let's start with you two.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Gary.
For the record, Gary Weeks. I'm a resident of Kaiser, Oregon, a reformed state agency bureaucrat, 31 years in state government. I had the opportunity to work with many of you over much of that time, and I appreciate the chance to be here. I think, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the first thing we'd want to say from the Student Access Commission is we have really appreciated being included in this process and the efforts you've made, the efforts that Ben Cannon and the governor's office has made to include us. And
yeah. Gary, let me just clarify that, you know, Gary is the citizen chair of the commission.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I should have said that.
His bureaucrat days are behind him.
They are. I'm reforming again. So and I think Ben's challenge is a great one to try to diagram what we're envisioning here for the future, knowing that it's a work in progress. I think, Mr. Chairman, as you have said, that we're moving possibly to a department at some point, but not there in the stage we're at now. So we have worked with the governor's staff and yourself, Mr. Chairman, to try to identify a way where the policy issues that the commission itself makes today become part of the responsibility for the HEC. The operational issues or the administrivia remain with some sort of a shell operation, a group like the Oregon Student Access Office or the Oregon Student Access Council. There has to be some organization to run the program while the policy decisions are moved to the HEC. I think, as I understand it, maybe the only change I would make in Ben's diagram is that I think the HEC has the authority to actually appoint now, under this model, the chief of the operations office of the Oregon Student Access Office. So maybe there should be a line there, a more solid line that shows that. But just understand that the policy issues belong to the HEC. There will be some sort of intermediary group that will manage the operations for the distribution of over $100 million in student grants every biennium. Not a small task and not something that you want held by the HEC without some sort of resource for them. So I guess in short, Mr. Chairman, we think this is a good, progressing as a very good model that's workable and appreciate the direction that it's going at this point.
Thank you, Gary. And, you know, I will add, colleagues, that we do envision, and it's called out in the statute, that there will be a technical advisory committee that will be, you know, reporting to the HEC, comprising financial aid people, the sort of the brains who are behind the OSAC currently.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Though this is not in statute for many, many years, the commission itself has had a student aid advisory groups made up of the financial aid officers from the three sectors, independent colleges, public four-year and public two-year. Those are the on-the-ground people that actually understand what happens in a student financial aid office, and they have helped the commission in the past to work on things like the student aid budgets, the eligibility criteria, the deadlines that ought to be in place, the distribution strategy for the grants, and we would hope that the HEC would continue to recognize the value of having an advisory council like that, whether it's in statute or simply appointed by virtue of their authority as the policy group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll add, we're also envisioning that the HEC will be advised by the Provost Council. You know, we heard about that when we were talking about the need to maintain the coordinated academic program, by the Inter-Institutional Faculty Senate, you know, which does the same thing, and hopefully it's analog on the community college side as well. Speaking of which, Andrea?
Thank you. Andrea Henderson, Executive Director from the Oregon Community College Association. Thank you for this opportunity to talk a little bit about the work group process and where we are. I think it's been a really good process to talk through how might this look and how might we re-envision how post-secondary education is structured on the state level. And I'm really pleased with the conversations that we've had so far. I know there's additional details still to be worked out, and certainly once we see a draft to say, you know, does the draft actually do what we hope that it does and what further refinements do we need? But I think in terms of the process, I think we've come a long way and certainly have some very specific work product now that's coming out that hopefully can get through in this legislative session. In terms of these specific pieces, from my perspective, what I really wanted out of the process, which I think is what we've done, is to really look at what should the responsibilities of HEC be. As we're creating this new entity, it can't just be a matter of, well, we'll take what the community colleges do, and we'll take what the universities do, and we'll take OSAC, and we're just going to kind of, you know, smush it together into one new kind of body, but really kind of taking the time to step back and say, okay, what is it? What is it that HEC does? What is that role at the state level? And what is it that we need that will actually forward how we're approaching post-secondary education in the state? And I think the drafts that are coming together really reflect that. In that it focuses on some of the key elements, that we need a place where there's that strategic look at post-secondary education, of all of post-secondary education, and saying where are we going, where do we need to go in the state, and how do all those pieces fit together. And having a place where that conversation occurs, I think, is vital. Some of the other key pieces that are reflected in here is having that ability to look and then the funding piece of it and say, how are we funding post-secondary education? How do the different sectors interact with their funding? And so what type of budget should be recommended to the governor and to the legislature? And then, equally as importantly, how is that money distributed out to institutions? And having that conversation, again, that's centered in one place, so it can be from a policy perspective that's in alignment with that strategic plan, I think is going to be very important. And then it's not just the institutions, but it's also the financial aid piece. So it's a collective look at all of the funding for post-secondary education and how are we leveraging it to move things forward. There's also a need for better data at the state level, both for the state to make better decisions, but also for colleges to make better policy decisions that are based on true data and not anecdotes. And I think that the HEC can play a role into continuing that process so that we have a better data system that enables that strategic decision making. And then lastly, really the role for programmatic approval, so that there's some place at the state level that as colleges and universities offer new programs, that there's a place for that conversation to say, is this program appropriate? Is it creating unnecessary competition between institutions in a way that can be perhaps handled differently? And so that HEC can hold that conversation. And then lastly, and probably the most important of all, is a place at the state level that's looking at the intersections between institutions and sectors, and really asking from a student's perspective, do the systems that we have in place for post-secondary education really enable students to move through it in a way that's timely and cost-effective? And I think that's also a critical conversation. Those are all very important things. I think at the same time, what the drafts don't represent is the state telling institutions exactly how to do all of that. So that really, in reflecting kind of the whole philosophy of tight loose, it's getting very specific and tight around what that state role is, and then backing out and letting institutions figure out how to get there in a way that's collaborative. So I'm hopeful about this process, that it's going to be something that's really going to help our post-secondary education system. There still are certainly a lot of details to work out. Certainly with the HEC membership, I think we would prefer a slightly smaller member board, but certainly there's going to be more conversation about that. But overall, I'm really pleased with the process, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Andrea. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andrea, I think that was the first time I've heard tight loose this entire session. There's a flashback. Like, that was the buzzword 2 years ago, was it not? So I'm glad you brought that up again, because I think that we need to revisit that again as we move forward to reflect on what our objectives were when we set off down this reform path. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that. Each session seems like a whole different vernacular and different. But I guess my question is, as you look at what's proposed and so forth, Are you encouraged? Are you more fearful? Are you more trepidatious? I mean, in terms of not just you, but I mean colleges in general. Can you see yourself in a better place, let's say, 2 years from now, or not? I mean, I know that's a huge question, but are you in it to the point that you can say, yeah, this I can see how this could work, how it could help higher ed in Oregon, or is it just another situation of, gosh, we're creating something that we are not quite sure where we're going or why we're doing it?
Chair Denbrough, Representative Johnson, yes. It's, I think in this process, I do have a lot of hope that we can get to a point where we have a post-secondary system that works better for students, that works better for that connection between the state and the local level, and it's a better partnership. But that's only going to happen, I believe, if we do it right up at the front end. I do have also trepidation that if we don't do it right, that we could end up in a system where we have a far more directive state down voice of you will all do things this way, kind of more of a tight framework. I think the language and the conversations we have now and in the next year as this is being implemented are really the critical piece for making sure it's being crafted in a way that really is about focusing that state interest on the appropriate roles of the state, really letting institutions innovate and do things the way they want. And most importantly, it's creating that partnership between the institutions and the state. So it's ideally what this does is create a shared vision that's held by both the state and institutions around where we're going in post-secondary education, and that each part of it understands, here's my role to help make that happen. That takes a lot of work and a lot of conversations and can't necessarily all be captured in legislation. So I think our goal right now is to make sure that the legislation allows that to happen and isn't restrictive one way or the other. And so, you know, over the next couple of weeks as we work on this, making sure that's right. But as important are the conversations behind the scenes in terms of what is the philosophy behind this and making sure that it's done right. From the college's perspective, there certainly is a lot of nervousness about all this change. I mean, it is a lot of change. Colleges like their independence. They like the way that they can be responsive to their local communities. We need to ensure that nothing in this process changes that, that if we do it right, it should enhance it.
Thank you.
Thank you for that, Andrea. And colleagues, again, I would really encourage you to take a close look at the new HEC authorities, because I think you'll see embedded in them many of the things that we've been talking about, you know, here as a committee for our priorities. You know, if you look at the strategic plan that's called out, you know, the goals of the strategic plan, increasing the educational attainment of the population, increasing the state's global economic competitiveness and the quality of life of its citizens, ensuring affordable access for qualified Oregon students at each college or public university, removing barriers to on-time completion. It will, you know, the HEC will be focusing on transfers and co-enrollments, accelerated college credit programs for high school students, programs and grants that span multiple institutions, creating a college-going culture, you know, just a number of things that we've really been focusing on that, I think it's very exciting to see these things embedded in the very core mission of the HEC. So thank you, Andrea.
Thank you.
Any further questions of Andrea or Gary? Okay, thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Drew, you want to come up and speak to the U.S.? Krista, did you need to say anything on behalf of CCW? Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Drew Hagedorn appearing on behalf of the Oregon University System. I think others have done an excellent job of summarizing the policy objectives here, and I want to express OUS's support for the direction we're headed with the forthcoming -3 amendments. We've greatly appreciated the opportunity to participate in the work group process. We've been actively engaged in helping craft the amendments that will be coming to you at a subsequent hearing, but we think this takes us in the right direction. I think Andrea did a good job of summarizing the importance of it for all institutions of higher education. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, for your interest in this important issue.
Thank you. Thank you, Drew. And I will add, colleagues, that Ryan Hageman, who's the general counsel for OUS, has been a key member of this process, and much of the language that you'll see in the authorities were recommendations that came from him. He's a great nuts and bolts kind of guy. He couldn't be here today. He's out in Le Grand. Thank him for us, please, Drew.
I will.
Yeah. Any questions of Drew, colleagues?
Thank you.
Great. Debbie, did you need to, would you like to come up and say anything? Thumbs up from Debbie.
Hi, for the record, my name is Debbie Kresge. I'm the Director of State Government Relations for Portland State University, and I've been a member of the work group that is bringing the legislation in front of you today. I think from Portland State's perspective, we are excited, not just to repeat what everyone else has said, which we are in agreement with, but we're excited about all the possibilities of what could come. In Portland, we are actively working with the OEIB around regional compacts, and we have great partnerships with our K-12 districts, and we have great partnerships with the community colleges and in our area, and I think that this gives post-secondary an opportunity to bring that to the statewide level at a much bigger thing. So we are excited about that. We're excited about the synergy and those types of things. So thank you.
Okay. Any questions of the Viking GR? Okay. Thank you very much, Debbie. I don't see Emma. Emma signed up to speak for this bill, but she must have been called elsewhere. Colleagues, I would ask you to please, if you can find the time to look over this material over the weekend. If you have any questions, we are hoping to get this for final drafting Monday morning. The working draft has already gone out or will soon go out to the different stakeholders, and we'll be getting their responses as well. Our goal, and you know, of course, we're coming up to the timeline crunch, but our goal is to have a final -3 amendment for you to vote on Wednesday morning, which is our last session, and then it'll go down to Ways and Means. Anybody have any questions about that timeline or about the process?
Mr. Chair, if we
yes,
want to propose some amendments, could we have those ready then by as soon as we can get them?
Yeah, if you could let me know over the weekend or Monday morning, you know, with Dan, you know, as I say, is the hope is that he will get it to the editors Monday afternoon, so that we'll have it in time.
We'll have the Ways and Means paper to move it down.
Yeah.
More policy and Ways and Means.
It'll be pretty light, but yes. Okay. Colleagues, with that, I'm going to close.
Chair, you want to consider, as I have, giving us next Friday off since our house work will be done.
Will you please stop stealing my thunder, Rep. Greenlick? Okay, I'm gonna first of all close this work session on House Bill 3120. Colleagues, we have a couple of bills that we have to carry over. We need to carry over 2149. 2152 and 3120. Colleagues, there's an excellent chance that a week from today we will not be meeting.
Object.
Yeah.
So use your time well, and we'll see what the schedule looks like. Perhaps we can take some additional time off as well. Okay, with that, colleagues, we are adjourned.